This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Haiti Adams-Fitzpatrick, and here is what's coming up.
There's a certain complete sort of absence of leadership in the country at the moment, and it's partly got to do with the fact that we're in lockdown, but it's partly got to do with the fact that people are just sick.
That's South African political analyst Peter Bruce on how the illnesses of several cabinet ministers, including the deputy president, are affecting the country as COVID-19 cases continue to spike. That story and more are next on Africa News Tonight. The Economic Community of West African States is meeting today for a virtual extraordinary summit to discuss the political crisis in Mali. Nicolas Pignon reports from Paris.
The summit takes place as the situation in Mali remains tense. The opposition M5 movement still is calling for the resignation of President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita. This demand is a red line for the ruling party and ECOWAS. The regional organization strongly contests any unconstitutional change, a position that has been criticized by protesters who think the heads of state are protecting one of their own. In this context, West African leaders are due to meet today via video conference. ECOWAS chair Niger President Mahamudu Issoufou claimed serious decision will be made. Seeking a way out of the crisis, ECOWAS mediators suggested forming a new unity government that would include opposition members and appointing new constitutional court judges who could potentially re-examine disputed parliamentary election results. The protest movement in Mali will end its truth after the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Adha scheduled for Friday. 11 people have died so far during clashes in Mali, according to the Prime Minister. The figure is 14, according to the UN's count. Nicolas Pinault, VOA News, Paris.
South Africa is averaging 12,000 new cases of COVID-19 daily and is rapidly moving toward 500,000 confirmed infections with nearly 7,000 deaths. The rising wave of infections is battering Africa's second largest economy. Hospitals are under severe pressure. The government is being criticized for not communicating adequately with the public as top officials come down with the coronavirus. Darren Taylor reports.
When President Cyril Ramaphosa addressed the nation a few days ago, he looked tired, breathed heavily, and his eyes were dull.
South Africa now has the fifth highest number of confirmed corona cases in the whole world and currently accounts for half of all the cases on our beloved continent, Africa. The coronavirus storm has indeed arrived, as we said it would.
Several of the president's cabinet members are sick with COVID-19. Political analyst Peter Bruce says the government's been surprisingly silent about this.
What we need to know about President Ramaphosa is what his state of health is. If he's being tested for COVID-19, we should know that he's being tested and we should know what the results are.
The government maintains the president's fatigue stems from his heavy workload, not because he's sick. Nevertheless, says Bruce, there's now a vacuum of proper governance in the country.
What happens if he gets sick? Because the deputy president, Didi Mabuza, hasn't been visible in these past weeks, citing ill health. So he's sick too. We don't know what with. There's a certain complete sort of absence of leadership in the country at the moment. And it's partly got to do with the fact that we're in lockdown, but it's partly got to do with the fact that people are just sick.
Ramaphosa's National Command Center establishes strategies to deal with the impact of the pandemic, but a key member, Trade and Industry Minister Ebrahim Patel, is down with COVID-19. Other ministers, some who have conditions such as diabetes, which makes it easier for them to get infected, are missing from parliamentary meetings. Bruce says Ramaphosa has failed to inform citizens of the plans, if any, to govern the country when ministers can't run their departments.
You know, the only way to restore public confidence is transparency, which Ramaphosa has been really, really poor at as COVID has spread. He's become less and less transparent and less accountable to the public, and it's wrong. And he would do himself an enormous amount of good if he started talking to us more informally, more regularly, and took questions.
South Africa's COVID-19 mortality rate has been relatively low, But Professor Adrian Puren of the National Institute for Communicable Diseases urges caution in this regard.
Those numbers are certainly increasing quite dramatically. The proportion, therefore, of people who have comorbidities will also therefore increase, and that could overwhelm, for example, our hospitals in terms of the ICU and high care capacities. We've seen, for example...
Scientists are concerned that South Africa's major form of transport, minibus taxis, are acting as so-called super spreaders and causing many infections. Some have criticized the state's decision to allow taxis to carry the maximum amount of passengers.
If we're speaking about physical distancing, hygiene around, or particular etiquettes around coughing, speaking, the wearing of masks, it really does become very difficult under those particular circumstances or very constrained circumstances. Having more than five people in a particular closed environment like that does increase risk, and how to limit that will be quite a challenge.
Scientific modelers say South Africa remains on track to record about 40,000 deaths by November. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
2 months after the arrest in a Paris suburb of Felicien Kabuga, the man suspected of financing Rwanda's 1994 genocide, officials in France announce they have located a former spy chief suspected of playing a major role in planning the extermination of the civilian Tutsi population, which ultimately led to the deaths of more than 800,000 people. VOA's Laurie London spoke with Paris-based journalist Catherine Field about the case.
Over the weekend, French authorities announced that they had opened a preliminary investigation into one of the suspects, one of the key suspects of the Rwandan genocide. It was the former head of military intelligence. His name is Aloys Ntahigabo. He was living in Orléans, which is about 100 miles southwest of Paris. All we know about him so far is what we've read in all the indictments and the evidence that was put forward by the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. Now, the main allegation against this former head of military intelligence is that from 1992 until July 1994, along with 11 others, he worked out a plan with the intent of exterminating the civilian Tutsi population by drawing up lists of enemies and their accomplices. Other indictments for various others that have the documentation in the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda say that he also took part in daily meetings at which they were informed of the massacres of the civilian Tutsi population. Now, of course, he denies these charges, and he makes it very clear that he was not in Rwanda on the 6th of April when that plane did come down. But it is pretty clear when you're reading through all the documents, all the indictments by the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, that he was indeed, or is, one of the suspected architects of that Rwanda genocide.
So now that they know his whereabouts, do we know if they've actually spoken to him and if they plan an arrest, or what are you hearing about what comes next with this if he's being investigated for crimes against humanity? And it's from France, not even in the International Criminal Court?
Indeed. It was actually a news website that tracked this man down. They had been investigating him for some 7 months, trying to find out where he was living. It's anyone's guess how many suspects from the Rwanda genocide are actually living in France. Depending on who you believe, there are at least a dozen. Others say there are several dozen. But this particular website had been investigating this man. His wife had come to France in 1998, was given asylum, and was naturalized French citizen in 2005. Now, that enabled him to join her here. And in fact, they've been living in social housing that's been provided for them at reduced rate by the state.
Wow.
That is as much as we know. the Paris High Court does have special powers to try crimes that were committed outside French jurisdictions. And this is the court which may end up hearing this. It's a special court set up in 2013, which can look into crimes, serious violations of international humanitarian law, and that is crimes against humanity. So they could be brought into this. They will be keeping an eye on this case. But there was a lot of criticism that this particular court isn't working fast enough and that this is exactly the sort of case they should have been looking into quite some time ago. But of course, all this does go back to, I think you could honestly say, that undertaking that French President Emmanuel Macron made in April 2019, that France would do all it could to ensure any genocide suspects who are living in France will be prosecuted.
And Catherine, I understand there has been at least one statement response about this from one of the groups, one of the communities working to seek justice for the horrific genocide.
Yes, in a statement, Bouca France did ask why so many suspected genociders who are on the run are living in France quite peacefully. And they do ask the question, why have so few of these people faced French justice for 26 years?
And that was Paris-based journalist Catherine Field speaking with VOA's Laurie London. The United Nations says the attack Saturday in Mastery village was one of the latest in a string of security incidents in the region. Sudan state media says the government will deploy joint forces from various state security services in Darfur. Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok told a delegation of Darfuri women that the force would, quote, protect people and secure the agriculture season. A recent study shows some countries with good health systems account for the majority of COVID-19 cases in Africa, while others with poor health systems had relatively moderate percentages of infection. Does that mean countries with the highest number of cases are the most vulnerable to the pandemic? VOA senior analyst Mohammed Elshenawy put that question to Dr. Joseph Siegel. He's the co-author of this study by the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, who also listed recommendations to mitigate the spread of the coronavirus in Africa.
Not necessarily. And I think that's one of the important things to keep in mind. Again, the data we're looking at are reported cases. And reported cases is a function of both health capacity to do the test and willingness, political will to do the test and then report on them. And those things don't always go together. And so I think it is important not just to be chasing the numbers, but to look at the broader range of risk vulnerabilities in these countries. And as we say, there's very strong differences in the risk profiles across the continent. And it's important not to just have a single lens in thinking about COVID-19 risk in Africa. I think we're likely to see more pronounced changes in the coming weeks as some of the in-country factors and vulnerabilities become more pronounced and the reliance on international exposure as a risk factor diminishes somewhat. And so it's important to keep an eye on. It isn't a static level of trajectories that we're seeing, and we very well could see some important shifts in the coming weeks and months.
With the fast rise in COVID-19 in the African continent, what measures are needed to improve efforts to mitigate an overwhelming spread of this virus in Africa?
Well, of course, this is the big question that everybody is grappling with. And indeed, since the 1st of June, we've been seeing a tripling in the number of reported cases in Africa every 3 weeks. So the transmissions do seem to be increasing. I would just briefly highlight a few things based on our analysis. And again, the response is going to depend on the risk vulnerability that each country faces. We can't apply a one-size-fits-all strategy. And I would start with the importance of prevention. You know, that continues to be the number one priority for the continent. The strength of Africa's public health systems are their community-level extension, health extension workers. You know, they know the communities. They're trusted by the communities. They can help communicate important public health messages. And so supporting that public health network and protecting those health workers, I think, needs to be the top priority. And I would also highlight the fact, because of the high levels of risk in densely populated urban areas, that there's a need to increase protections for vulnerable populations. So these are people in informal settlements or displaced persons in congregated areas. So increasing their public education and awareness of the virus, providing more access to hand washing, sanitation, encouraging face masks, providing alternative transportation options, those sorts of things, discouraging large gatherings inside and buildings. I think that's really important for protecting those vulnerable populations. Another key priority is for countries in conflict. And again, we saw higher levels of risk in countries in conflict. And that's both because the conflict is a distraction for governments and their response. It also limits testing, so we don't really know how badly the transmissions are in these countries. But also, you know, conflict creates displacement, and displacement creates a risk, not just for those populations, but for the broader population. And so, you know, recognizing these risks, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres had proposed early on that there be a global ceasefire during the pandemic. And this parallels initiative by the African Union for silencing the guns, again, looking at ways of reducing, mitigating conflict. But this is very relevant in our pandemic response. So looking at ways of mitigating the instability caused by conflict and therefore contributing to a more effective response to the pandemic. Then finally, one of the important findings is the importance of a free press as a public health response tool, that more open reporting on the pandemic is leading to better responses and more public awareness and more public cooperation. And so we don't often think of a free press as having a very central role in a public health response, but indeed it seems to be highly relevant. And there needs to be greater efforts to protect journalists. You know, there have been too many African countries that have arrested journalists for reporting on COVID-19, when in fact, this is an important tool for public health response and educating the public so that they can better prepare themselves.
That was Dr. Joseph Siegel of the Africa Center for Strategic Studies speaking there with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Elshenawy. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Haley Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington. Here's a recap of our top stories. The Economic Community of West African States is meeting today for a virtual extraordinary summit to discuss the political crisis in Mali. Officials in France say they've located a former Rwandan spy chief suspected of playing a major role in the 1994 genocide. And more than 60 people are dead and nearly 60 others wounded after an armed attack in Sudan's Darfur region. You're listening to VOA Africa. For more news and information, visit our website at voanews.com. The United States and the European Union have expressed disappointment with the removal from office of Somali Prime Minister Hassan Ali Khayre, calling the move a setback to progress and reforms in the East African country. Khayre lost a no-confidence vote in Parliament Saturday after he recently told his cabinet that the country should hold elections on time without extensions. Somali political observers say the process to remove the Prime Minister was illegal. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees is warning that unlawful and arbitrary incarceration of refugees and asylum seekers is putting them and the general public at heightened risk of COVID-19. The UN Refugee Agency is calling for their urgent and immediate release. Lisa Schlein is in Geneva for us with this report.
Some countries are reportedly using the coronavirus pandemic as an excuse to lock up refugees and asylum seekers for longer periods of time. The UN agency says refugees are fleeing war and persecution. It says they are not criminals and should not be detained without due legal process. The agency says refugees and asylum seekers often are forced to live in overcrowded and unsanitary conditions. It says social distancing in these settings is impossible, and access to medical care and clean water is limited. UNHCR spokesman Charlie Yaxley tells VOA the risk of a catastrophic outbreak of COVID-19 in one of these detention centers is great and could jeopardize public health.
Even and should somebody become infected with the virus, it could potentially spread quickly amongst the other detainees, but also amongst those who work and guard the centres themselves and therefore potentially risking further spread even outside the centres.
The UNHCR says unlawful detention of refugees is not restricted to countries in conflict, such as Libya. It says it also is widely used as an administrative procedure in all regions, in Europe, Africa, Asia, and the Americas. Yaxley says the detention of refugees should be a measure of last resort, adding that children should never be held in immigration detention. He says this can never be considered to be in the child's best interest. The UNHCR, he says, is calling for the immediate release of all children from detention, as well as for refugees and asylum seekers being arbitrarily or unlawfully detained.
You know, we believe that releasing asylum seekers from detention is in the public health interest, not only of the United States, but for all countries. The detention of adults should only take place in exceptional circumstances, and the detention of children, irrespective of their immigration status, should never happen at all.
The UNHCR urges governments to expand and implement community-based alternatives to detention, including other options for newly arriving refugees and asylum seekers. It says detention center conditions should be improved while alternatives are being prepared. It adds the UNHCR should continue to have access to asylum seekers and refugees held in these locations. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Kenya Private School Association is lobbying the government to help sustain their schools and teachers after authorities announced that because of COVID-19, schools cannot open until January. Kenya's Ministry of Education is supporting public schools and teachers, but many private teachers have had to turn to other jobs to survive financially. Lenny Ruvaga has the story from Nairobi.
About 10 kilometers from Nairobi lies the estate of Kayole, where we find 26-year-old Kezia Karanja preparing her beauty shop, a daily routine that she has learned to perfection in the last 8 weeks. Karanja and her colleague Rebecca Atuti, both private school teachers, pooled their financial resources and began this business together 2 months ago at the onset of the nationwide COVID-19 lockdown in Kenya. The teachers, who both teach humanities, make an average of $10 in sales daily. However, Karanja says that because they are on indefinite unpaid leave from their jobs, finding the money to keep their shop running is quite a challenge.
We don't have enough stock so that you can sell the products. You see, when you're starting a business, you should have enough stock so that you can sell to the customers. But you're having challenges that if someone comes for a certain product, you don't have because you don't have the money to have the stock.
In mid-March, the government suspended learning in all institutions in a bid to stem the spread of COVID-19. While public school teachers are still drawing salaries, many private school teachers are not. Peter Ndoro, the chief executive officer at KPSA, wants the government to offer financial support to private schools. Ndoro told VOA that about 1,400 teachers have lost their jobs as a result of school closures. The rest are on unpaid leave.
During this period, what is it that will be happening? There will be no revenue coming in. But private schools closed because they wanted Kenya to be safe, heeding to the president's call that all schools should be closed. So what is it that needs to be done? These institutions need to be supported by the government.
With a workforce of around 300,000 teachers, private schools have requested a $7 million grant to pay salaries and offset mounting costs. Zach Kinuthia, the Education Chief Administrative Secretary, says the request is under consideration.
If we can say that they want to be removed from the gridlock that is almost decimating them, it can be considered at higher levels and agreements can be made. You know, there is no money. You know, taxes are not being collected as they used to. We are struggling to get income. But just something can be done so that we also save them.
For now, Karanja and thousands of other teachers drawn from private schools across the country are turning to alternative sources of income and vocations to support their families. Lenny Rovaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. Thank you for listening, and thank you for choosing the Voice of America.
Sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.